The character Atticus Finch was a hero in his kids' eyes, and he's been a hero to children all around the world who've read To Kill a Mockingbird or seen the film adaptation.
In this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal.
Harper Lee's story of a gentlemanly Southern lawyer who defends a black man charged with the rape of a white woman may be a work of fiction, but our next guest says Atticus Finch might be based on a real person, his father. Joe Beck is an Atlanta-based lawyer and author of the book My Father and Atticus Finch, A Lawyer's Fight for Justice in 1930s Alabama. It comes out today. Joe, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
When did you first make the connection between the character of Atticus Finch and your dad?
When I was growing up in Montgomery, Alabama, which is the town we had to move to after my father's law practice and enterprise dried up, the people would hear about this case and hear me talking about it all through high school, college, and immediately say that that must be To Kill a Mockingbird, because it was a trial by my father representing a black man charged with raping a white woman in a small South Alabama town where violence was threatened, and it just seemed to have a lot in common with that case. But it was many years later when I began to really pursue this. It occurred on a fishing trip with the man who turned out to be the agent for Harper Lee. I didn't know that when we went fishing together, but when he heard this story, he said, "I want Nell," as he called her, to respond to this.
Nell was her first name, Nell Harper Lee.
Yes, and he knew I was just trying to find out information about my father, and of course the story of what he did was public. Ms. Lee wrote back a very gracious letter. She said there are some obvious parallels, and she saw those. She said she didn't recall the book. Recall the case, but she was very interested in helping me. And one of the things she suggested was that there would probably be no newspaper coverage, and therefore it would be hard to find out about the case. But she was wrong about that. There was a lot of coverage because the trial was surrounded by 16 Alabama Highway Patrolmen to preserve order and basically to prevent a lynching. The defendant was himself removed from the jail in Troy, Alabama, and taken to Montgomery for what the newspaper calls safekeeping. Now, my father was a lawyer in Enterprise, Alabama, which is about 50 miles from Troy. And the reason the reason he got the case was because the lawyers in Troy had themselves appointed special prosecutor or came up with other conflicts. They did not want to take this controversial case. My father willingly took it.
Let's take the story step by step here, Joe, because one of the things you state very early on in the book, and I want to be careful because the book almost reads like a novel. It's all factual and a memoir, but I don't want to give away what happens. But at the beginning, you're very careful to say that your father and grandfather weren't sort of crusading anti-racism men, and you tried to establish that quite early. Why?
You say they were or were not. I couldn't understand.
Were not. You were especially not. In relation to your grandfather, you were saying, "Look, don't put either of these men on a pedestal."
Well, my grandfather was regarded for the times, and that is the late 19th, early 20th century, as a racial progressive. He paid a black man to supervise white men at his sawmill and paid him more than the whites. He also bought one of his employees out of peonage, which is a form of indentured servitude that replaced slavery. So he was regarded as a progressive, but by today's standards, he would be very paternalistic. As for my father, I think his greatest passion was for the Constitution. He believed this man, the fact he was black didn't matter, deserved a lawyer and a good lawyer. And so my father willingly and happily took the case.
Well, wait. You said at the very beginning he wasn't all that happy because a judge called him, asked him to take it, and almost he was still at that point hoping to get out of it.
At that point, I don't think it, I didn't mean to convey that he was hoping to get out of it. The fact is that he was startled. He had not heard of this case. It was all over the newspapers in Troy and Montgomery, but he was in a different town. And the judge called him out of the blue and said, I want you to defend a black man charged with raping a white woman. And my father's initial reaction was, let me look at my calendar and see if I can work this in. The judge was insistent, and my father took the case quite willingly, in fact, but it was a bit of a shock to be asked, and he decided he was going to do it.
So he moved forward with this case, and he encountered a lot of difficulties. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the things that made this case particularly challenging for him as an attorney?
Well, you begin with the fact that no African Americans were allowed to serve on the jury. Two were called because of the Scottsboro case ruling a few years earlier, but they were immediately struck by the prosecution. That, by the way, is a practice that has continued in Alabama and other states until quite recently.
I want to make sure everyone stays with us. The Scottsboro Boys was the case in which there were a group, nine black teenagers accused of raping a couple white women. This was also in the 1930s. And this figure's fairly large in your book and in the case that your father tried. But pray continue. He was trying to get some African Americans on the jury. He could not.
That's right, but the Supreme Court said they have to be at least called for possible service. What happens in a trial is the jurors are called and lawyers pick the ones that they want. And if a lawyer does not want any African Americans on the jury, up until quite recently, it was very common for them to come up with an excuse to strike that juror. So the two black men who were called to serve were both struck. I say men because women were not allowed to serve on that felony jury in Alabama back then.
So that was one of the first difficulties. He also did not have the defendant was very different than the defendant that we got in To Kill a Mockingbird in terms of his attitude and character. Can you tell me a little bit about the defendant in your dad's case?
Well, if you compare Charles White, who's known as Charles White alias, the defendant in my father's case, with Tom Robinson, the fictional character in To Kill a Mockingbird, there's really no comparison. Tom Robinson was obsequious, deferential, which is a way that black men had to behave back then if they didn't want to be killed. Charles White was from Detroit and Chicago, and he did not have that same deferential attitude. However, by the end of the trial, my father had come to really respect him, and there was genuine affection between the men. And I don't want to do a spoiler and tell how it turned out.
Yeah, I don't want you to either.
That affection and respect became quite mutual. And one of the nice things about the story is how their relationship developed. And in a lot of ways, I have to say, with all respect to Harper Lee, that Charles White is a much more fully realized human being. He is not a stereotype at all. He's a real character, and I came to be very fond of him as I researched him.
We would love to hear from those of you listening. Atticus Finch, clearly one of the most famous literary characters to come out of the United States. And I wonder who is a favorite literary character for those of you listening. You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation that happens on Facebook. My guest is lawyer and author Joe Beck. His new book is titled My Father and Atticus Finch, A Lawyer's Fight for Justice in 1930s Alabama. Along the way, one of the things that sort of helped you to write this book was not just your father's notes, but it sounds like he really spoke with you openly about many of the deeper issues behind this case and his philosophy on the law. What did you learn growing up, before you even went back to research this, what did you remember about this case?
Well, even before this case, of course, I did hear about the case and well, let me answer your question. I'm sorry. And then I want to tell you what I learned about
sure.
the law. What I heard both from my father and my mother was that this was not right, that the case came out wrongly, and that my father's career was basically ended as a result of doing the right thing, and that was not right. And in the very first sentence in the preface, I write, my father did not sell for his worth. His sister told me that, and my mother did not disagree. What did that mean, I wondered as a child, and I go on to explain that only as an adult did I come to realize it was about this case. And, you know, the phrase "sell for his worth" is kind of a Southern aphorism, but it meant he never got the credit that he deserved. When his career was destroyed, he could not get the kind of job he wanted as a lawyer, and so he had to wind up working for the Veterans Administration in Montgomery. Now, as for what my father taught me about the law, a vivid memory that I describe in the book was the day in 1954, I think 11 years old, when the Brown versus Board school desegregation case was handed out. In Montgomery, there was tremendous negative reaction to that. Ugly words, the N-word, cross burnings, all kinds of things were going on in response to that case. The day it was decided, my father, when he got home from work, took me aside and he said, "Son, you're going to hear some high talk about this, but I want you to know that the Supreme Court decided it correctly." And he went on to explain what equal protection meant under the Constitution, and it could not continue to be justified to send blacks to a separate school because separate was inherently unequal. Now, I was 11 years old, and when he explained it, we weren't talking about the Charles White Alias case. We were talking about race relations. There's another example or two in the book, including my attendance of a Jacksonville Braves game.
Yeah, tell me about your seeing a very famous ball player who's still unknown.
This is kind of on a lighter note, but it's a fact. I think I was 12 by then. We went to Jacksonville Braves Montgomery Rebels baseball game. We went to games from time to time, but we wanted to be there for this one because it was the first time that black baseball players had played in Montgomery. And there were some really ugly shouts and some taunts, and violence was threatened. We could hear it because we sat right behind the Jacksonville dugout to show our support. As the black players came out of the, there were only two, came out of the dugout and stood in the on-deck circle, the shouts grew louder. But one of the players got two hits, and the second hit was a double that rattled the scoreboard. I didn't put this in the book, but I remember it as knocking the lights out, and there was about a 10-minute delay. And when the game was over, my father turned to me and he said, "Son, I don't think we'll see this man in Montgomery again next season." And sure enough, Hank Aaron was called up to the Milwaukee Braves that year. I had the pleasure of telling Mr. Aaron that when I met him a few years ago at Georgia State.
Reading this book, it occurred to me that this incident in your family's history, which had such a huge impact, not just on you and your dad, but your whole family, it really could have soured your relationship with the law, and yet you decided to be a lawyer. Why?
Well, I hate to say that, to be flip about it, but I it was not so much the inspiration as I needed to do something. I wanted to be a writer, but the law was something I did all right with and had a good career with. I did begin my career as a neighborhood legal services lawyer in Washington, D.C., representing poor people. It was in a so-called law reform program, so we took high-impact cases. One of my clients was Marion Barry, who at the time was not using any serious drugs. And we filed a lawsuit against the ABC affiliate in Washington because there were no black people on TV.
Marion Barry, you mean the former mayor of D.C.?
The former mayor of D.C. who was indicted, I guess, served time, maybe, can't remember.
Yeah, he did.
For cocaine use. And my early career was to some degree in keeping with my father in that I was giving up some income to represent people who were indigent and people who were discriminated against. I then came to the Kilpatrick Law Firm in Atlanta because it was the most progressive law firm in town. Some of the firms in Atlanta back then did not hire blacks, women, or people who were Jewish. Kilpatrick hired all three. And I admired that in the Southern firm in 1972. Today, to their credit, the Atlanta firms are all very proactive and non-discriminatory. But back then, it was different in 1972.
Joe, we have about a minute left, and I wonder, since you have a feeling that there is a connection between your father and the character of Atticus Finch, what did you think about how Atticus Finch appeared in the second novel, Ghost Set a Watchman?
Well, as I write in the preface, my manuscript had been accepted before Ghost Set a Watchman. When I heard the book was coming out, I thought, well, that's going to be the end of mine. Even though it was accepted for publication, there would probably be a decision not to go forward. I, of course, bought the book immediately, and I was appalled that anyone would consider my father to be like the Atticus of Watchmen. But as I also make clear in the book, there were both kinds of Atticus in the South in those days. There were some white men who were brave and did the right thing. My father, Morris Dees in Montgomery, the head of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Judge Frank Johnson, there were many. Well, not many, there were a number.
Yeah.
There were also some vicious racists and people like Bull Connor that we know all too well.
Yeah.
But there are also some people in between, people who showed some courage but not a lot. This
right.
judge showed some courage
but
in protecting that defendant throughout the trial, but ultimately, I think he crumbled.
That's Joe Beck, lawyer, author of the new book, My Father and Atticus Finch, A Lawyer's Fight for Justice in 1930s Alabama. The book comes out today. Joe, congratulations and thank you.
Thank you so much.